Dharma could be said to be a tradition, a teaching, a practice, and a realization of deconstruction almost every moment we are involved in constructing ourselves, each other, a world, even sometimes on nights like this, constructing Buddha Dharma. That's what we do. As sentient beings, we're construction workers almost incessantly. Even in our dreams, we can't stand to just like stop constructing even while we're asleep, right? Amazing. So sometimes I think of the heart of Buddha Dharma as a deconstruction project. Or we could just say a non-construction project. Sometimes it has, we emphasize methodically deconstructing our constructions in a similar manner to the way in which we constructed them. And sometimes we just say, just don't even worry about deconstructing the construction. Just stop constructing for a little while. So we have lots of elaborate teachings on how to deconstruct. And then we have very simple practices of non-construction, like Zazen. You might say, well, I don't think of my practice. It doesn't really seem like a deconstruction practice. That sounds too tricky or something. I just like to sit. But what is our sitting? If we're sitting and really letting go of thoughts, which are the constructing tools we use, and we're just being present, maybe a little bit of construction going on, but less than usual, if not none, then that's what I mean. Like, whether we think of it that way or not. And that's what's so nice about Zazen, so relaxing. We're so busy constructing all day long that we just can take a break for a while, just rest in the present, rest our constructing frontal lobe of the mind, of the brain, and just be. So that's the very simple version of deconstructing. Just sit. We don't need anything further. In fact, anything further could just be extra constructions to confuse us more. But we do have in our tradition more elaborate instructions too. For example, our great ancestor Nagarjuna was the master of deconstructionism. That was his big project. Using the workings of the constructing mind to deconstruct the workings of the constructing mind. That's Nagarjuna's method. For example, he would say things like, no thing ever arises caused by itself. A thing arising is like a thing coming to be. No thing ever comes to be caused by itself. Things don't cause themselves. But also they don't arise caused by others. And they don't arise caused by themselves and others. And they don't arise without any cause at all. sometimes called the tetralemma, the four-pointed lemma. It's not a dilemma. It's a tetralemma. It's a four-pointed problem. And a lot of Nagarjuna's reasonings uses these four. It's not this, it's not that, it's not both, and it's not neither. So that kind of, if you carefully go through each step, you can basically constructing ends. If you do it carefully enough, upon the last step, you see that actually nothing, therefore, can arise. If it doesn't arise from these various kinds of causes or from no cause, then ultimately speaking, in the end, nothing truly arises. So that's a big topic we don't need to get into fully tonight. But all this is by way of introduction to tonight's case in the Book of Serenity, case 6. Called Matsu's White and Black. We sometimes hear about those colors in Zen stories and poems. Maybe just to go back to Nagarjuna for a minute, he's through this kind of deconstructive logic, one of the main teachings he proposes is there's two truths. There's a conventional truth, which is the way things appear to arise. Even if we can see that really, ultimately, we can't really find anything actually arising, we definitely can find things appearing to arise. In fact, we do basically every moment, are experiencing the appearance of ourselves, each other, a world, and even Buddha Dharma are all appearing to arise. And Nagarjuna says we don't deny that, we don't try to stop appearances from arising, otherwise we just die. So we honor appearances and we call them a truth. This kind of truth of appearances called conventional truth. Conventional because we all kind of pretty much agree on it. We have some arguments about conventional truths, but you know, for the most part, we pretty much agree that like this is a room for the time being. We, at least we can try to agree to call this a room. That's conventional truth. Kind of constructed appearance. And then ultimate truth is that there really is no room here, and that nothing truly arises or comes to be. And we also honor that truth. They're both truths. They're both honored. And then there's somewhat elaborate and wonderful teachings about seeing how these two truths are actually not truly separate. Like, y'all probably know the Heart Sutra. It's kind of about that. Form, this appearing, arising physicality we call form, is itself emptiness. It's like the conventional truth is itself the ultimate truth. And anyway, in Zen, we sometimes say black is the dark realm where nothing can be distinguished. The world of the ultimate truth where you can't see anything. You can't say anything, and you can't do anything. And then we have the world of light, where you can see all this stuff, and you can do all this stuff. And then we have poems that say things like, "Right in the light there's darkness, but don't confront it as darkness. Just enjoy the light." And right in darkness, there's light, but at the time of the ultimate truth, don't see it as light. Just rest in the darkness. So the way the light and dark work together like this, like forward and backward steps, is a way of talking about these two truths in Zen poetry. So this case tonight is called Matsu's Black and White, or White and Black. Matsu is one of the greatest teachers of the golden age of Zen in China. And they have, he had 139 Dharma successors. I once visited his temple in China, and it's kind of like just tucked into a city block right now. But they said that in its heyday, when Matsu was alive, it was so big that there's so many people practicing there that to close the temple gates at night, they had to ride a horse around the compound. It was so big. Where was it? When? Like the 8th century. 7th or 8th century. Yeah, in China. The Tang Dynasty. So the introduction to the story says, where you can't open your mouth, or where you can't say anything, right, like in the dark, a tongueless person can speak. Where you can't take a step at all, a legless person can walk. If you fall within their range of these tongueless, legless people and stagnate at a statement, how can you have any freedom? Like if you encounter these tongueless, legless people who still can speak and walk, and they bring up something, they bring up a statement, and you stagnate when you hear it, meaning like you don't know what to do about it, how can you have any freedom? When the four mountains all oppress you, how can you penetrate to freedom? Maybe those four mountains are like Nagarjuna's tetralemma. When it arising from something, arising from itself, from arising from another, arising from both, or arising from neither. When all those possibilities start to press on you because you see that none of them work, then you feel very stuck. The case goes, a monk asked Great Master Matsu, apart from the four propositions and beyond the 100 negations, please, this translation says, directly point out the meaning of living Buddhism, which is Thomas Cleary's liberal translation of, please directly point out the meaning of the ancestors coming from the West, is what it literally says, which is the Zen way of saying, what's the the meaning of living Buddhism is, why did Bodhidharma, the first ancestor of Zen, come from India to China? And so it's just the poetic way, the Zen style of asking, what's the direct living meaning of Bodhidharma? Why did the Zen founder bother to come into this country of China, where there were already all these teachings? They already were studying Nagarjuna. So the four propositions are just what we've heard, right? There's various versions of them. Those might sound like, we could say four propositions are, could it be that things arise from themselves, from another, from both, or from neither? Another version of four propositions are, could it be that things exist, they truly exist, or they don't exist at all, or they both exist and don't exist, or they neither exist nor don't exist. There's various versions of the tetralemma, which kind of all come down to the same thing, though they sound a little different. So the four propositions of Nagarjuna's middle way teachings, and the 100 negations, which is just to make it even more complicated. It doesn't say this here, but Suzuki Roshi, in commenting on this case, is the one place where he brings up his teacher, Kishisawa Ion, elaborated what the 100 negations are. Suzuki Roshi just felt like, yeah, we have time to like talk about what are the 100 negations, even though it's not really the point of the story. And I don't know if this is even true, but here's one possibility. Is you take those four propositions, or you take that tetralemma of Nagarjuna, and you apply each of the four to each of the four. You don't need to try to do this right now. In fact, Nagarjuna might even say, like, warning, do not try this at home. Or you might not ever leave the house. But if you multiply four by four, you get 16. And then you multiply that by three times, past, present, and future, you get 32. And then you multiply it by the two truths of conventional and ultimate, you get 64. No, 16 times 3. 64? 64 times 48 times 2 is 96. And then you add in the four tetralemma again, just for good measure. And you get 100. That's an esoteric teaching of Kishisawa Ion. You will not be tested on this. So this monk asks Master Matsu, he's maybe been studying Nagarjuna. Maybe Matsu's even been teaching Nagarjuna, right? And he's like getting tired of it. And he says, apart from these four propositions and beyond the 100 negations, can we just put all that aside for a minute? Please directly point out the meaning of the ancestor coming from the West, the living meaning of Buddha Dharma, the living meaning of the deconstruction tradition. And Master Ma said, I'm actually tired out today and can't explain for you. Go ask Jert Zong, one of my students. So, that's what the monk did. Can you believe that? He went over to Jert Zong's room and asked him the same question. And Jert Zong said, well, why don't you go ask the teacher? And the monk said, well, the teacher told me to come ask you. The monk said, the teacher told me to come ask you. And Jert Zong said, actually, I have a headache today and can't explain for you. Go ask Brother Hai. This is Baijiang Huai Hai. So again, the monk. Knock, knock, knock. Brother Hai, are you there? Yes. Can you please tell me, apart from the four propositions and the 100 negations, please point out directly the living Buddha Dharma? And Hai said, when I come this far, or at this point, after all, I don't understand. So at least he didn't tell him to go talk to somebody else. But that was the end of the conversation. So then the monk went back to Matsu, the teacher that he started with, and he reported these two stories from these two students of his. And Matsu said, Bai Zhang's head is white, Huai Hai's head is black. That's today's story. Have any of you heard this story before? Oh, what a treat. I love this story. It's a kind of like one of those wacky Zen Madhyamaka stories. They're not, you know, this sounds, if you've ever read Nagarjuna, this sounds very different. But it's really saying the same thing. It's pointing it out directly. Please point it out directly. So, you know, Master Matsu has these bodhisattva vows to help everybody in every possible way. So, no matter how tired he is, you know, he's not going to neglect his bodhisattva vows. Especially, like, how much energy does it take to, like, directly point out the living meaning, you know? If he said, "Can you please explain Nagarjuna's logic?" he might really say, "I'm actually really tired. It's going to take like several days, and I got to get really rested up before doing that." But as far as Bodhidharma's meaning of coming from the West, that's, you know, very simple. Takes almost no time. So, do you think he neglected his duty by saying, "What's the direct meaning?" And Matsu said, "I'm tired out today and can't explain for you. Go ask Jurzang." You appreciate it. Yeah, so the story just could have ended there, right? It could have ended. But it couldn't end because this monk had to construct something. And he was already maybe thinking about the four propositions and 100 negations and like, what's the logic behind this? And like, okay, he's going to explain the logic now. Get ready. Pay attention. What do you mean you're tired? And can't explain. I'm ready for the explanation. The way I think the explanation's coming. It should sound something like Nagarjuna, at least, right? And the great thing is that Matsu didn't just say, "I'm tired out today and can't explain for you." He actually, like, just to kind of test to see if he got it, he said, "Actually, go ask him. Go ask this other guy." And instead of laughing like you did, he actually said, he delved into the content of the words and followed dutifully the instructions of his teacher. Go ask him. And then Jurzang, as a disciple of Matsu, are also skilled in directly pointing out the living meaning. When asked this question, he said, "Why don't you go ask the teacher?" Period. It's nice when they ask questions, because then it's kind of like, well, is that a question to answer? So then the mom, he didn't even think twice, because when we're used to hearing questions like that, we assume that we have to then do something about it, like right away, right? So he said, "Well, the teacher told me to ask you." But like Dogen likes to do this, right? As for those in the Buddha Nature class, you know, when the question is asked, "What is your name?" I think was one of the sayings that from last week in this story that Dogen's quoting. "What is your name?" question mark. It's more like we think, "Oh yeah, now I have to answer that," instead of hearing it as a definitive expression of "What is your name?" or "Your name is what?" And you are whatting your name, and your name's whatting you, and all of that. So it's tricky, because if we just take every expression we hear just as like, that's just everything that everybody says is like a poem or something, and we just take it at that, maybe nothing would get constructed. We just say, "Wow, you said that? You can say that? That's amazing. That's just like poetry." Even if somebody says, "Can you take out the garbage? That's a brilliant poem. I never heard that one before. Let's write it down and make a whole collection of poems." The first one will be, "Can you take out the garbage?" But if we did that, then like the garbage wouldn't get taken out. So it's good sometimes to say, it's not just a poem, it's actually like something, it's an instruction. But maybe both. Maybe we could do both. Hear it as a poem, and take out the garbage at the same time. And maybe that's what that monk was doing. But maybe not. You know, maybe he's like, "Oh, okay, I got it, the story's over." But he did say to go talk to this other guy, so we can do that also. Even though the story's over, and in case they record this later, it'll make it even more interesting. Let's go talk to the next one. And the next one, "Why don't you ask the teacher?" "The teacher told me to ask you." And he says very similarly, it's funny, you wondered if this was part of like their style of like talking about their physical ailments in Matsu's community. So, you know, Matsu says, "I'm tired today and can't explain." Jirtsang says, "I have a headache today and can't explain." Maybe they all, maybe that was their practice of like mindfulness of the body, right? So they just, whenever you're asked any question, just like state your physical condition. It's a good meditation practice, right? It's very direct. It's like, this is what's happening now. You're asking me a question, but actually, the most direct thing for me right now is I have a headache. And I actually can't explain. But just to keep this going a little longer, why don't you go ask my Dharma brother down the hall. And the Dharma brother down the hall says, when he is asked the question, he doesn't actually state his physical bodily condition. He just says, "When I arrive right here, I don't understand anything at all." Kind of quite a different response. And that's really the end of the story. There's no more going on to the next one here. Kind of like, maybe he even appreciated that. That's more like it. Even though I actually wanted a more elaborate explanation, at least that fits into my idea of Zen teachings. Because Bodhidharma, after all, the one who came from the West to point out the living meaning, when asked who he was, he said, "I don't know." So we already have that tradition. So, you know, what was I expecting more than that? But he got several answers before that too. And then Matsu says, the first one's answer, "I'm tired and have a headache," that Zhang, who said, "I'm tired and I have a headache," his head is white. And Hai, who said, "I don't understand," his head is black. And then, you know, you hear things here like, you know, this is impossible to, like, swallow these words. So difficult. This commentary says, this statement, Zhang's head is white, Hai's head is black, this statement kills everyone in the world without doubt. And the Blue Cliff Record has the same case, and it says, like, people explain this black and white in various ways, but everything they say is way off the mark. In the commentary here, Wansong, the commentator, says, Huangbo, this other ancient ancestor, said, if you want to understand directly and immediately, everything is not it. Or nothing is it. If you want to understand directly and immediately, like this monk did, nothing is it. I, Wansong the commentator, say, if you understand clearly and thoroughly, nothing is not it. There's two sides. We could hear that as, you know, nothing is it is like the ultimate truth, and nothing is not it is kind of like the conventional truth. Everything is included. There's nothing, no thing that's not it, conventionally speaking, but ultimately speaking, when we look deeper, nothing is really it. And then he says, the great master Nagarjuna said, wisdom is like a mass of fire. It cannot be entered from any side. Yet he also said, wisdom is like a clear, cool pool. It can be entered from any side. There's always two truths. You can't have one without the other. So, Jane, apart from all these propositions and negations, can you just, you know, briefly point out the direct meaning of coming from the West? Oh, Kathy.
Oh, okay.
Apart from all these propositions and negations, can you directly point out this living meaning of Buddha Dharma? Johnny, what color is Jane's head?
Jane's head.
What color is Kathy's head?
Kathy's head.
Oh, Rob, what color is Johnny's head?
No head.
Patrick, what color is Rob's head? Well, it seems like it's not so simple as black and white around here. There's many colored heads, right? And this story is kind of nicely seems to break down into, like, there's a kind of a white answer and a kind of a black answer. But when you say a head's a head, Still, if we have to choose, that sounds kind of like a white answer, you know. Whereas, sounds pretty dark. But then the one song, the commentator says, I say, John's head is white, Hai's head is black, a duck's head is green, a crane's head is red. The ten-shadowed spiritual horse stands south of the ocean. The five-colored auspicious unicorn walks north of the sky. People everywhere, do not depend on a fox spirit. Tian Tong has the real story. His verse says, medicine working as illness. It's mirrored in the past sages. Can you hear how Matsu is always dispensing medicine? But when he said, I have a headache, I can't explain, go talk to him, his beautiful, appropriate medicine kind of made this monk sick, didn't it? I mean, sick in the sense that it kept him constructing. It didn't just stop his constructing, right? It made him go on, talk to some other person, construct a little more. Medicine working as illness, it's mirrored in the past sages. Illness working as medicine. Sure, but who is it? I have a headache today. Sounds kind of like an illness given as medicine to this monk. White head, black head, capable heirs of the house. We definitely should not see that black is better than white, or white is better than black, or emptiness is better than form, or form is better than emptiness. How ridiculous that would be, wouldn't it? Or that I don't know is a better answer than I have a headache, or I have a headache's better than no answer, or a head is a head is a better answer than blah. Or Matsu is better than Nagarjuna, or Nagarjuna is better than Matsu. I'm sure there's people with each one of these opinions in our constructed world. Yes, Michael.
I'm back with something you were saying before about the head color and black and white. Black, whether it's your additive or subtractive color, black contains all the colors and white can contain all the colors.
Huh.
So black can be white and white can be black, so...
Is that right from an artistic point of view?
Yeah.
That black contains all colors?
Well,
if you mix all colors...
It will come out black, but if you do like light with a color wheel...
Yeah.
And the center is white. So whether you're black or white...
Is the center really... How does the center get white with a color wheel?
I just don't
guess. But you can't actually mix colors to get white.
White or black, depending on what you're dealing with, additive or like substitute. It takes all the colors to make white.
If you're putting colored light together... white. If you're putting colored pigment together, it'll be black.
Hmm.
But it's still got all the colors.
That's actually a really great kind of metaphor too, right? Because pigment is this kind of like solid, murky stuff, earthy, gooey stuff. You mix it all together and you get black. You get like you can't you take form, and you mix all the forms of these paints together, and you get the unknown. And then you take a light, which is like this ethereal, formless, ungraspable radiance, and you put that together, and you get light where you can see tangible forms, and you can distinguish the 10,000 things. So it's kind of neat that you know how light and pigment kind of create their opposites or contain their opposites in the way that emptiness itself is form and form itself is emptiness. Medicine working as illness, it's mirrored in the past sages. Illness working as medicine, sure, but who is it? Or, sure, but what does it require? Here's another translation. Whitehead, blackhead, capable heirs of the house, statement or no statement, the ability to cut off the flow. It's possible to cut off the flow of the constructing mind with a statement like, I have a headache. Nothing more can be said. Have tea and go. Period. Or no statement can cut off the flow. Like, blah. Or, clearly sitting, cutting off the road of speech. Laughable is the old ancient all at Vaishali. Vaishali is the city in India where Vimalakirti lived. And so this is, you know, an obscure reference to many, but maybe in those days, people knew. Zen ancestors loved the Vimalakirti Sutra, where one of the culminating scenes in the sutra is all these bodhisattvas are talking with Vimalakirti, and they're all trying to express the Dharma gate of non-duality. And if you read the sutra, it's a delightful chapter because they give great explanations in words of many different Dharma gates to non-duality, like many entrances to realizing non-duality. And they give better and better answers until they're finally, you know, not really better, but they seem better, right? Until they get to Manjushri, the perfect wisdom bodhisattva, and I can't remember what he says, but it's brilliant. And then Manjushri says, okay, Vimalakirti, we've all spoken. Now you tell us, what's the Dharma gate to non-duality? Vimalakirti in Vaishali says, and they call that the lion's roar of Vimalakirti. The thundering silence of Vimalakirti.
Wasn't he sick?
His sickness was working as medicine because it drew all these bodhisattvas into, I guess we should go see him since he's sick. And then he would just like test and probe them until they, if you know the story, it's a great story because actually he's such a wise, he's a lay bodhisattva. He lives in the world with his family and career in Vaishali, and all the monks are terrified of him because he's so wise. And they're like, we shouldn't, he's going to show us up our ignorance. So they're like, I know he's sick, we should visit him, but can you go instead? Because he might ask one of those questions. So, but they do go. And he does show them up. But here, in a way, Matsu kind of, in a way, maybe shows up Vimalakirti. Not Matsu, Tian Tung, who's writing this verse. He says, statement or no statement, the ability to cut off the flow. Clearly sitting, cutting off the road of speech. Laughable is the old ancient awl, the old ancient ice pick at Vaishali. That sharp-witted Bodhisattva, Vimalakirti. He's kind of laughable in his silence, in his lion's roar of silence. You know, we don't know. Is it laughable because how delightful after all this talk he expresses it the best? Or is it that, like, that seemed like the best, but actually, how about Vimalakirti saying, by the way, I'm sick today, in case you didn't notice, all this Dharma talk, did you forget that I actually am really ill? But maybe if you said that, no one would have gotten it. It wouldn't have cut off the flow of construction for those bodhisattvas, because they're like, well, that's really mundane talk, Vimalakirti. We don't want to talk about your sickness. We want to hear about the Dharma gate of non-duality. And maybe Vimalakirti would have laughed at them and said, oh, children, go have some tea. Matsu's black and white. Some commentaries say that his head's black, his head's white is just another statement. And some say it's a brilliant exposition of the two truths. There's actually a point behind that. It's not some random statement. All these weird, random seeming Zen statements are not really random. There's a poetic wisdom in all the words. Yes.
The one who he said was black was the one that said, I don't know.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
And the one who he says the head was white was kind of like trying to construct something and thought that someone else might have more than he, you know.
Well, I think the one who said, the one whose head is white said, I have a headache today.
Mm-hmm.
Specific.
Yeah. One is a concrete statement. The other is a meta statement. It's a statement about.
Mm-hmm. So. But we can also see this as two truths.
Two truths, yeah.
That in ultimate truth, I don't understand anything. I can't say anything. I don't understand a thing, ultimately. But conventionally, and in Zen, of course, we celebrate both. We sometimes say, like Bodhidharma, I don't know who I am. And we sometimes say, let's have tea and let's, when we're bowing to the Buddha, or taking out our bowing cloth, let's turn to the left, not the right. Unless we're standing on this side of the altar, and then we turn to the right, so we turn away from Buddha. Kind of ridiculous, huh? Because why does that matter in the ultimate truth? And why does it matter that we have headaches in the ultimate truth? But this is our world. We have a world of bowing cloths, headaches, tea, and all these other appearances, miraculous appearances. Headache is like, if you really contemplate a headache, it's a total miracle, right? That we we can experience such a thing. We're actually like experiencing like this head is hurting. That's like, it's beyond amazing. Whereas actually like no headache, which is the ultimate truth, is that there's never been a headache in the history of the universe, is not that amazing, actually. It's not amazing. And it's not amazing. What's that?
I mean, it's amazing if you haven't had a headache before and then all of a sudden you see no headaches.
Oh. Yeah, I think we could say it like that. Yeah, if you've always had a headache and then suddenly there's no headache.
I guess I'm thinking of like the vowel symbol a little bit when you think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reason I say it's not amazing is because, like, nothing, you know, in the ultimate truth, there's like nothing happening. There's nothing. If you say like this is amazing, the ultimate truth, then that's just a conventional emotion. It's like it's not amazing and it's not ordinary and it's not interesting and it's not boring. It's not good or bad. It's like not actually anything, the ultimate truth. Not even amazing. So we might wonder, like, well then, why are we put so much emphasis on the ultimate truth if it's not even interesting? That's the call for tonight. May all beings enjoy headaches, no headaches, both headaches and no headaches, and neither headaches nor non-headaches. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Divisions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.